Well, welcome back to Speaking in Tongues here on KDVS. We have with us now Stephen Moore. Steve is a literary critic from Michigan, I guess these days, and author of, An Alternative History of the Novel, Volume 1, The Novel to 1600, recently released. And then also what we're calling, we're going to get to that in a little bit, but author of, I want to say, two critical works on William, two book-length, two monograph-type critical works on William Gaddis, the novelist.
Yeah, that's right, and I edited another one, and I've written several articles, but yeah, that'll do.
Well, I seem to remember, like, there was the Twain series that I think, did those go by Understanding William Gaddis?
Yeah, it was simply called William Gaddis. It came out about 89 or so. And then before that, I wrote a reader's guide to Gaddis's first novel. And then I also did a collection of essays on Gaddis with John Kuehl, the late John Kuehl.
That's right. You know, I don't think I would ever have gotten through the Recognitions without that reader's guide.
Well, thanks. I sort of wrote it just to get myself through it. I mean, I read it the first time, and I loved it. But, boy, there was so much in there I didn't quite follow. So I figured I want to tie all this down, you know, so it took me a couple of years writing it for myself and for others as well.
Well, I thought, you know, the only thing I can think of where I was as tied to the reader's companion like that was Anthony Powell's Dance to the Music of Time.
Oh.
That goes on for a million words, you know, it's 12 volumes. It was the last Christmas I was in school the last time, and I had 3 weeks with no papers, no assignments, one more class to take, and I sat down and read that whole thing, and it was just, you know, it was like...
It's marvelous, isn't it?
Oh, I couldn't believe it. It's so much fun. I send friends, you know, the first volume or the first book, and I've given away two or three copies of Hillary Sperling's, you know, companion there, the Invitation to the Dance, and I just thought that was so much fun. But anyway, we keep skirting around, and we're here to talk about William Gaddis. And I realize, well, he may not be a household name to everybody. He certainly is to some of us. But could you tell us a little about Gaddis and his work and what it means or something?
Okay, sure. He died about 12 years ago. He was born in 1922, same year as Kerouac and Vonnegut, and kind of a big year for that generation of writers. He wrote his first book in 1955 called The Recognitions, which is a huge 960-page encyclopedia of a novel that was compared by a lot of people to Joyce's Ulysses, which is what caught my eye, but not in 55, but later when I heard about it, because I was a huge Joyce fan. It's sort of about forgery, art forgery, and counterfeiting, and he opens that up as a big metaphor for everything that's insincere about the modern world, the way he saw it back in the 50s. It was panned, unfortunately, and it's a, you know, classic now. But it's part of the Penguin Classics. Back then, it was just a little too weird, too real for people, as they said. So he kind of went underground. 20 years later, he came out with another huge book, over 700 pages, called J.R., named after the main character, a boy named J.R. Van Sant. It's sort of a satire on the abuses of capitalism. Not capitalism per se, he always pointed out, but the abuses of capitalism. It was a little better received, got good reviews, won the National Book Award, to everyone's surprise, in 1975, although it never did quite catch on. It's a rather difficult book. It's told almost entirely in dialogue, and over the course of 700 pages with you know, maybe 100 different characters, it can be rather daunting, but it's a magnificent work. Then 10 years later, he wrote a third novel called Carpenter's Gothic, which is the shortest book. It's only about 260 pages long. Sort of about the rise of the Christian right in the early 80s, which really scared him and scared a lot of people. And then about 10 years after that, 1994, he wrote his last major novel called A Frolic of His Own, which is sort of a satire on the legal industry. And the whole litigious tendency a lot of people have in America these days to go to law to solve their problems. And then about 2 years after he died, his estate published a short little thing he had written on virtually on his deathbed, kind of a 60-page monologue called Agape Agape, about an old man sitting on his deathbed thinking about back on his life. So it's basically four novels over a period of about 40 years, which doesn't sound like much, but like I said, they're huge novels, they're packed with information, and Gaddis saw himself as sort of a social critic. So each one takes on, like, the art world in the first one, and then the financial world in the second, religion in the third, and law in the fourth. So he's basically covering all four cardinal points of the American civilization, and he didn't like what he saw. Starting back in the 50s, he thought America was on the wrong track, and as a prophet almost, he tried to warn everyone, you know, and then realized that no one listens to artists, so the best he can do is just witness his time and make it, you know, as real as he possibly could, which he did. I mean, his ear for dialogue was incredible. He's extremely well-read. He kept up with the news, so they're very, you know, well-informed, elusive kind of works. And he's emerging now, you know, after his death especially, as, you know, one of the top three or four writers of the American writers of the 20th century, right up there with Pynchon and a few others that, you know, operate in that era.
Well, it's funny you say that, because I was a Stone Thomas Pynchon fan many, many years. And then when J.R. came out, I was in school. And so really it wasn't until Frolic of His Own came out that I really sat down and read it. And, of course, I had some professional interest in it. And, of course, it starts off justice. Well, you get justice in the next world. In this one, you just have to take what you get, whatever the rest of that line is.
Yeah, you get the law.
Oh, my God. And I read it, and I just could not believe it. I was just beside myself. It was so astounding. In fact, the comment that got me about it, and of course, you know, you said Gaddis wrote four novels and a little novella. He got two National Book Awards, as I recall, for his four novels, which is a mighty high batting percentage my book. But you know, Louis Auchincloss, who died, I want to say, about a year ago now at 92, and people sort of said, well, he's old-fashioned, blah, blah, blah. And Gore Vidal said, wait, this is the guy who tells you what the lives of our rulers are like in their boardrooms and their parlors and their lives. And you don't have any sense of how valuable and how rare that is. And Auchincloss said, oh, Gaddis knows more about law than we lawyers do. You know, and Auchincloss wrote, what, 40 or 50 novels,
all sorts of
critical studies of Edith Wharton and Henry James and all sorts of people. And he looks to Gaddis as somebody who knows about the law. And I think, to me, it was there's no way you say it's an easy end. There's no royal road to sort of getting Gaddis. I mean, you can read Carpenter's Gothic. It's, as you say, 260 pages, but you know, you're trying to think, what's going on here? There's this heiress in a rented house in New England, and her husband is sort of coming and going, and this guy who has some stuff in storage in the house is coming and going, who's the real owner, and her husband is tied up with some, shouter in, I don't know, South Carolina and Africa or something, who's drowned some kid baptizing him. And
one of those southern preachers. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, you're right. That's the easy Gaddis book, and even that one's hard to get through.
Well, you're not clear exactly what it's about for the longest, except that what's going on is so hair-raising. You know, the husband is like one of those West Point Trig kind of guys, you know, like the E. Cummings of Olaf Gladden Big poem, where he's, you know, shilling for this guy who's obviously a terrible fraud.
And he was in Vietnam too, and he's been denying all his life that this power structure that he's now working for, the ones who sent those people over there and got them all killed. So he's got his own problems with that.
I think that leads to my second favorite sort of Gaddis quote, and somehow this seems more generalized in its origins, that it's Gaddis's world and we just live in it.
He seems to have predicted so much that went on. I mean, I mentioned Carpenter's Gothic is about the rise of the Christian right in the 80s, and back then, you know, who paid much attention to those clowns? But, you know, those are the people that reelected George Bush in the middle, 6 years ago. And the whole financial crisis that we're in now, I mean, Gaddis saw that a quarter of a century ago. J.R. is very much about the corporate world and how corporations control, you know, not only Wall Street, obviously, but the government and the upper classes with their foundations and everything else. And he saw how the corporate world was really getting its tentacles around every aspect of American life. And, you know, those people, the what they call them, venture capitalists, and those people who go in and take over companies and ruin them and then get rid of them, and, you know, all that kind of activity. And this was years before the banks became deregularized. So, which, of course, opened up another Pandora's box of ills, you know. So he saw how, and even in JR, he goes back to, he talks about the robber barons of the 19th century and links modern Wall Street with the robber barons to point out that, unfortunately, maybe this is just the way America's always been. It's always been a plutocracy, you know. Only a fool would think it's a democracy. And, he nailed it. And
well, it's really astounding to me, because when JR was published was just at the moment that really our current financial crisis began to make itself apparent to people who were paying attention. I was involved with people who were bothering the power company down in Georgia because they were trying to build all these power plants that we said they didn't need to build. And we said, you know, be careful, Wall Street will get hold of you.
And
they didn't, and they did, you know. At JR, I mean, I sort of hate to jump from book to book, but I feel like saying, you know, very briefly, what is it? The grammar school class goes to the bank, to the stock exchange, the bank one.
Yeah, a sixth grade class goes down to Wall Street. They buy one share of some stock, and that kind of starts things off. And
there's a little kid named JR who's just a snotty-nosed 11-year-old in sneakers, and he gets hold of that share, and he goes down with a nickel and calls on the payphone in the school hallway and starts trading. And what does he get? Cases and cases of plastic picnic forks or something.
Yeah, something from the Army. And then just, mail order acquisitions and penny stocks. And somehow he just, by playing the game, he doesn't understand the game, but he just does what the big people do. And he pretty soon has his own financial empire. And since he really doesn't know what he's doing, he just winds up ruining all sorts of other companies and businesses and everything, because he's saying, hey, this is what you do, this is what the adults do. And Gaddis is really pointing out that our Wall Street financiers are basically like 11-year-old kids with no sense of morals whatsoever. So and again, you're right, that was back in the 70s before we started really just started hearing about some of the shenanigans. And and nowadays I can't believe what they're getting away with. I mean, it's almost a good thing Gaddis is not here. I mean, he would be spinning. I mean, he would just slit his throat if he heard about what's going on.
You can't imagine. You know, he would only be in his late 80s, and I'm sure I had had some indication. His daughter Sarah, who actually published a novel herself called Swallow Hard a few years back, that was a lot of really pretty enjoyable, and talked about, you know, in a fictional way, growing up with her father, who was very focused on his writing and on his work, and a man obviously of you know, sort of iron will like that. And I'd be flattered no end if she were in fact tuned in. But in JR, there's Edward Bass, the frustrated artist trying to write a symphony and being balked at every turn and ending up, you know, writing a little melody for unaccompanied cello is all you can squeeze out of art in this day of the age of iron that we live in now.
It's all of his novels are filled with frustrated artists, and and, you know, a lot of the troubles they have are their own troubles. I mean, you know, Gaddis knew that, you know, artists are not the most well-balanced people on earth, you know, but still, yeah, creating art for a society that doesn't want good art, all they want is just cheap entertainment, is got to be tough, especially if you're someone like Gaddis who has sky-high standards and wants to write something that's going to last for centuries.
That's what's so astounding, and I guess this will work us back to the recognitions and the time leading up to that, and we'll have touched on almost all the novels, and I'm sure we'll get back to Agape Agape before we're done, but it's 1955. This young guy who went to Harvard, I think he was involved with the Lampoon or the Crimson there, and came down and was a fact checker at the New Yorker for a couple of years, and I want to say the late 40s, and then traveled for a few years, and then came back and sat down and wrote this book, 900 and something pages, and he gets it published, and he thinks, okay, this is it. I'm gonna, you know, be there, I will have arrived. And he got savaged because nobody wanted to sit and read the book.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I think the year before, Invisible Man came out. And, you know, that set Ralph Ellison up for life, you know. And, and that's the way Gaddis thought. And in, in a just world, that's exactly what would have happened. But and it's so ironic because the main character in The Recognitions is an aspiring artist. And he gives his first show and is panned. And he's so dispirited by that that he becomes a forger of old masters. And turns out that's exactly what happened to Gaddis. His first book got panned, and he wound up writing speeches for corporations and things. But, yeah, it was an amazing... I mean, you know, who starts off with a, you know, debuts with a 960-page novel? It was a very audacious thing, but he wrote it over a period of years, and as he explored this idea of forgery and counterfeiting, he just kept seeing how that was kind of a master metaphor for everything that's going on. How Christianity was sort of a plagiary or a forgery of pagan religion, and you know, people were forgeries of their true selves. You know, phoniness. Remember that Salinger talking about phoniness?
Exactly.
And, you know, that whole thing. And this is when Madison Avenue was coming on strong, and talking people into buying things they didn't need, and just a kind of a general phoniness and everything creeping into the culture that, and a vulgarity too that. Gaddis was kind of an upper-class person himself, you know, Harvard and all that, and just the cheapening of America and the vulgarity he saw around him. He thought it was like ancient Rome with its bread and circuses. That's the way he thought we were descending, and God, I hate to say it, but I think he's right, you know.
Well, and it was so funny because you get a view of that same Greenwich Village, Bohemian New York, at the same time as those early Kerouac novels, but from a completely different perspective and a completely different point of view, and you even get a couple of characters bleeding over, and historical people like Shelley Martinelli as Esme, and those various parts of Gaddis, you know, the Wyatt, the art forger, and Otto, the would-be artist poseur kind of guy who's searching for his father, and you know, just all those characters who you sort of think like Dostoevsky, they're just sort of plucked out of pieces of the author, and they go around being autonomous characters in this novel.
And very intense, just like Dostoevsky. I mean, these people are just really intense people. I mean, The Recognitions really reads like a Russian novel at times, which is no mistake. Gaddis loved the Russians. I mean, you know, Dostoevsky especially, Gogol, Tolstoy. He saw himself working in that tradition rather than an American tradition, to be honest. So... there's that, yeah, that intensity of arguments, the intellectual arguments they have that you see in Turgenev and all those other 19th century novels really meant a lot to him.
I just, you know, the when you start talking about these books, this stuff just sort of comes out. You say, oh my God, you know, he's got the little Infanta that died and is off to be buried in state, and there's a Barbary ape somewhere and all that, and the phony doctor that kills the, you know, Wyatt Gwyn, the main art forger's mother on the ship, you know, and just his father turning into Zoroastrian and preaching to the sun.
Mithraism, actually, but yeah.
Right, exactly. sorry, Mithraism. Yeah. I get all those mystery cults mixed up in there. But the aunt, the old Puritan aunt,
sort of
not approving of Reverend Gwyn and his growing craziness, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Just these characters just keep coming at you.
It's such a weird, strange book. I mean, that's another thing that appealed to me. I mean, it begins almost like something out of Poe or Hawthorne, you know, the New England setting and the minister poring over his books of forgotten lore and all the magic and mysticism and all that. And yet, other parts are in Paris, some parts are in Greenwich Village with all the hipsters. In fact, there's even a line from Burroughs' Junkie that's in The Recognitions. Gaddis knew those people and hung out with them, so you're right about the bleeding back and forth of characters. And it's an amazing book that has everything that's in it. As I said, it's almost encyclopedic. There's hardly anything that's left out when you look into it.
No, I'm one of those people that ran into Edward Mendelsohn's term of this encyclopedic narrative, and to me, you know, it's like there's Rabelais with Gargantua, and certainly, you know, Gravity's Rainbow, and these other enormous books that, that retell the, you know, the world in which they're written, and the recognitions, just to me, that's the 50s. You know, you can talk about all the other stuff, but if you want to say, what were people really doing in the 50s?
Yeah, know. It's all in there somewhere. Yeah.
Somewhere. That's, the, how, speaking of writing for years, I mean, writing that original Reader's Guide to the Recognitions, what was, that was uncharted territory. What was that like for you?
Oh, that was the most fun I ever had in my life. It was like putting together an enormous crossword puzzle where I went through the novel and wrote down a little index cards, everything that needed to be explained, and I first did all the easy stuff, you know, the literary quotes from Shakespeare and stuff that I recognized, and then just started filling in the gaps, and, you know, Gaddis refers to the Golden Bough, for example, that, you know, Fraser's great book of anthropology, so I think I'd already read that book, actually, so I dug that out, and that led to explaining a lot of certain references. And then I recognized something from Graves' White Goddess, and that, and I just, as I started following these things through, one book led to another, and I looking back now, and this is the pre-internet days, of course, I don't know how I did it, because there hadn't been much written about Gaddis. I didn't have any previous scholarship to go on, but just by following leads and my own intuition, and I had some incredible finds, too. I was at the library one night looking for one book that I thought might be appropriate for Gaddis, and this other book was just kind of sticking out for some reason, and I picked it up, and it turned out to be one of his major sources for books on the saints. It was just accidental. It's like, you know, the fates were pushing it in my direction. And another time I went to a library, and I requested one book, and they gave me the wrong book by mistake, and that wrong book turned out to be another book that Gaddis used that I didn't know about. So I think it was a very exciting time putting that all together. And Gaddis himself was blown away by it, I was told, which really pleased me. He really liked the fact that someone went to that all that effort to do that. And now it's wonderful. It's now on the this wonderful website we have, Gaddis Annotations. I don't know if you've ever seen that website.
Oh, I'm hoping we'll have a copy audio file of this interview to be put on there. Victoria Harding is really to be congratulated for maintaining that site. There's just enormous amounts of information. And
yeah, so now I've got that reader's guide online, and I'm able to keep updating it. So I'm getting close to having, I mean, there's when I published the book back in 82, there were a lot of things I just could not locate in Gaddis's novel. But over the years, I've knocked out most of them, so I think I've plugged almost all the holes by now. So that's, yeah, that's fine. And then I've done the same with the other novels as well, which is all on Victoria's website. And you're right, that's a fantastic resource for Gaddis scholars.
That's right, and we may as well say right now, there's also the discussion list that she moderates, Gaddis L, I think it's called. It's you can get to it from the website, and it comes and goes in activity, but I know one Sunday morning I was reading something, and somebody said something, and you popped up with a rejoinder, and I just had to send a note that said, good grief, you know, you've got... You know, you say something, and the guy who's written the critical, work will come back at you if your timing is right. But it's just, hey, I think we're all in your debt for you know, doing all that critical slogging to show, you know, what the I don't know, all the meanings and interpretations of all these, you know, just ridiculously dense and erudite works that this guy wrote.
Well, we're probably scaring off a lot of people because, the books aren't like, they're not physics textbooks. I mean, they're not that difficult, but if you, they are a bit challenging, and it helps to, you know, have background information. But, you know, Gaddis always thought he was writing for a more general popular audience. He wasn't like, I don't know, a Gilbert Sorrentino or someone writing for a very, you know, elite kind of audience. I think he misjudged himself. I mean, his books are more difficult than I think he realized, but he still, you know, he did want them to be entertaining and fun.
And I know I've sent friends, either particularly Frolic of His Own or J.R., and they'll go ahead and plow through them, you know, people who are regular readers, and say, you know, I laughed all the way. I laughed until I snortled, you know.
They're
such amazingly funny books of...
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's essentially a comic novelist. I mean, he really liked Evelyn Waugh, for example, and As serious as his themes are, his presentation is comic. And he was a satirist. I mean, as you point out, he worked for the Harvard Lampoon, and that kind of sense of burlesque and satire never left him. The world has become so satiric now. I don't know how someone writing in 2010 would. I mean, in the old days, a satirist would take something going on and then exaggerate it to cartoonish dimensions and write about that. But now I look around and seem like everything is cartoonish dimensions.
Exactly. The world is a cartoon now.
Yeah.
And you wonder.
How do you satire something like that? So where were we? Comic novelist. So like I said, I don't want to scare off your readers. I mean, Gaddis' books are a bit challenging, but they're entertaining, and you're right, very, very funny once you kind of, get with it.
And I think that's the thing for me. Jonathan Franzen tried to make part of his reputation attacking Gaddis for being difficult, and it's like, well, I'd rather have difficulty than cookie-cutter characters and plots and all of that. I'd rather be challenged by a writer who exhorts me to get in there and figure out what it is he's doing and follow him down the paths of that he's exploring, rather than, oh, well, this is a big seller, we all better like it and say it's good, or we won't be with it. When we're talking about comic, I can't tell you, as funny as JR is and as amusing as things that happen in there, the things that go on in A Frolic of His Own, I could not believe it. I was just in stitches the whole time. The Oscar Kreese is he's an adjunct instructor at a community college and up near New York City.
Yeah.
He manages, while fooling with his car, to be run over by his own car, and the brand of which is the Sosumi. And he's just been run over by his own car, so he goes and gets a lawyer, and he says, well, I want to sue the company, and say, well, now, in order to sue the company, you have to sue the driver, and, well, admittedly, the driver's you, but nonetheless, you have to sue yourself to sue the company to get all this, and then you have, the lawyers and the non-lawyers and the relatives and just his girlfriend and his sister and her husband, sort of the one decent guy, is this what his sister's husband?
Yeah, the sister and Harry. Yeah, there's. But you're right. The rest of it, and of course, Gaddis documents this all with legal citations. I mean, he read the American Jurisprudence, that big 100-volume thing. I mean, he really knew the legal lingo and. I understand that the novel is a great favorite of lawyers and even some Wall Street types.
Well, I know for me it's just wonderful. I spent many years at the bar myself, and not an abogado in the state or anything, but the opinions of Judge Kreese, who was, a colleague of Oliver Wendell Holmes or Learned Hand, I forget exactly whom right now, but those opinions are just beyond masterful when it comes to legal writing, as far as I'm concerned. He describes the case of the dog trapped in the giant sculpture and the owners trying to get the dog out and the artist and other art supporters trying, or art lovers trying, to protect the sculpture from being wrecked to get the dog out, and just the these opinions are just sprinkled through there, and the writing is just so astounding.
And this Olympian irony. That's the one thing Gaddis loved about the law, not all the shenanigans and all that, but the language that those old-time jurists used to use, trying to bring order to a chaotic world via language and making the language as precise as possible, but also as beautiful and as encompassing as possible. And he loved just the language of the law and what it tried to do, like I said, bringing order to this chaotic world. I don't know if jurists still write in that way or not, but...
not many, I'm afraid.
Oh, well, but you're right. It's a neglected area of belles lettres, perhaps, legal writing, and Gaddis certainly imitates it to a T, really does celebrate that kind of writing.
Yeah, I really just couldn't believe it, because I know I'd never, I think I said I never have parsed any of it real closely, but I've sat down with some of those opinions and started sort of briefing them out a little bit and realizing it's like, this is the epitome of elegant, concise, incisive, judicial writing.
Yeah, yet it still managed to be witty and entertaining and moves the plot along. So,
and he's the father. Judge Kreese was the father of this clown Oscar, who's run himself over with his own car and having to sue himself, and yeah. All those things. And of course, then what is it? The insurance company ends up with a lawyer who's not really a lawyer.
That phony
Basie, Count Basie.
Screws things up, and then it's almost like a Marx Brothers movie at times, because then he gets in that whole plagiary thing where he thinks someone's made a movie based on his old play.
He has this awful play about the Civil War that he wrote, and some terrible TV movie's been made, and he's trying to sue because they've stolen his movie, and he thinks he'll get a ton of money out of that, and it turns out his remedy is that the play will be the movie will be suppressed, so he won't get a nickel.
Yeah, so again, almost running himself over with the car again, just shooting himself in the foot, and
Exactly. No, I think to me that's the thing. When you say comic novel, it's novelist. It's not so much that in the end, boy gets girl, and everybody's happy, and all the colorful characters stand around and say, "Well, wasn't that something?" Classic comedy. Because underneath it all, there's that coruscating view of how our lives have become just a mockery of real life. How our society has degraded or degenerated to the point that, you almost can't have a full human life anymore.
Yeah, no, none of his novels have happy endings, and he almost says, what can you do anymore? You can just laugh at it, and, the laughter keeps you from suicide.
But certainly, you look now, and we've got Newt Gingrich running against the 99ers, saying, well, those people that have gotten 2 years of unemployment insurance are just welfare queens. They should all have to get job training. I mean, this was like yesterday.
Yeah.
He's getting ready to run again in 2012, pretending it's 1994, and he can attack people who are 2 years unemployed, losing their houses, no prospect of coming back, and he's going to run against them. It's like, dude, I think the numbers are turning against you now. You're not going to get a lot of people who don't fall in, who haven't been affected by this, and unless you think that the few who haven't are going to fund your rise from the ashes. Coming from Georgia, I had a lot more of Newt than some people might have, and that's a whole other story. But
then it's good for you, isn't it?
Oh my God, it's so true. Now, I think we've been through this, that, and the other. There are two things I want to be sure to touch on before we get done. One is Agape Agape, and the other is The Player Piano.
Those two are related. Yeah,
exactly.
Gaddis was interested in The Player Piano even from back in his New Yorker days in the 40s.
I remember a piece in The Atlantic in 1951.
Yeah, that was part of it. The Player Piano, just as a metaphor for this mechanization in the arts and the degradation of the artist. I mean, in the old days, if you want to play the piano, you had to spend years and years learning it. But with a player piano, all you had to do is just pop in a roll, and you could pretend like you're playing it. And Gaddis thought that was a very, very sad or bad goal to be going on. And so he planned on writing a nonfiction book about that, and then he set it aside and then wrote J.R. And at the end of his life, after he wrote Frolic of His Own, he got a contract to write this nonfiction book, to resume writing this on The Player Piano, and he couldn't quite pull it off, so he decided to convert it at the last minute to just a person thinking about the whole project and why he couldn't write it. And that's what Agape Agape became, just a a little 80 page monologue about someone thinking about this project and no longer having the ability to write it, and thinking back about his youth and how much more ambitious he was back then. It's something, it's something he was interested in all his life.
Well, and it's so interesting because narrative, that monologue, he's still talking, he's still clutching at his papers, and he's still saying, I've got it here somewhere, I know I've got this, it's all there, and it's so astounding. He just, as you say, on his deathbed, he's still still trying to get it out and still trying to say the. I want to say the piece from the Atlantic in 1951 is called Stop Player Joke Number 4. Mm-hmm. And he talks about the fact that, you know, starting early in the 20th century, the production of player pianos really overtook pianos generally. And to me, it's always sort of a parallel. There were 22,000 studio musicians in the mid-1920s in the United States, theater musicians, excuse me. Mm-hmm. And when sound movies came in within a 5-year period, suddenly there were 4,000 theater musicians in the United States.
Yeah.
And the same sort of thing with being able to make your own music on the piano and having a player piano, and suddenly the player piano replaces that. Nobody plays the piano. They sit down and play it. Then the radio comes in. Then the TV comes in. Then you get the internet and, you know.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Gaddis didn't touch upon this, but I think the same thing happened in the 80s when anyone could buy a synthesizer and a sampler, and without being a musician, could actually start making their own music. And then you have DJs now who consider themselves musicians who are just basically spinning records, you know. And
unfortunately, these people aren't musicians. They can, so maybe some are, but most of them twiddle dials and rock the mic, and that's art. I don't know. I mean, I guess so, but I'm.
So that's, yeah, even though he doesn't treat that's part of the whole arc he was concerned about, how the art in America is degraded by all this, by mechanization. And he struggled with it all his life. He just never could quite get the book done. So the Agape Agape is just a little, you know, attempt to sum up what he couldn't do. So.
Well, and I remember, I don't want to say it's in J.R., there's that character Gibbs, who's named for Willard Gibbs, the great physicist, who's trying to write the book about the theory of everything and how, I mean, I'm trying to even say what that book would be about, but it's the big scientific theory of everything. And, of course, he can't get a foothold and he can't get it going and he's driving himself crazy to do it. And
yeah, Gaddis was writing about himself at that point, as all of his novels have an autobiographical character in there. So, and he was struggling with it back then and, struggling with it up till the day he died.
That's right. The apartment that the guys share that has the faucet, the tub never stops running. It's just entropy is running, and you're not able to get your book written, and your life has gotten away. It's just like, how does this guy do this? It's so astounding to, and I think that's the thing I would say to people is put aside any notion of the difficulty of the work, put aside any notion of the scholarly nature of his concerns or intellectual depth of what he's doing, and just read the stuff and get sucked into that world he creates, because it is our world and his world, and we do just live in it. I mean, to say today, you know, art is forgery and, politics is a clown show and finance is a casino that's set up to take our money. You know, it's just like, how did he do that?
Yeah, he saw it all coming. And it's a remarkable testament to, the fall of America. I mean, I hate to be so pessimistic, but I think that's the way he saw it, and I'm afraid more and more of us are seeing it that way.
Well, I don't think there's much way you can say that the guy missed it. You know, I certainly look at it and say, well, this is exactly the world that I seem to be living in, you know, that is the one that he predicted for us. So, no, well, Stephen, I see we have run clear out of time, and there's plenty more stuff I'm sure we could talk about. And when I thought, oh, we have 45 minutes with Stephen Moore, then it's like I wish I had 4 hours, because it's there to be talked about. But thank you so much for joining us today, Steve. And we've been talking to Stephen Moore, the literary critic, author of a number of critical works on William Gaddis and of the alternative history of the novel, Volume 1, The Novel to 1600. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right.